It raises uncertainty of the state's support for AGEA at a critical time.
Lawmakers question whether the state's Gasoline Inducement Act is working. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 4th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, are state scientists tangled up in state politics?
I've worked for the state of Alaska for the last 35 years on various projects or for them, and I've never seen anything quite like this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Association of Alaska School Boards, AASB, promotes one-to-one digital learning for all Alaska students to prepare them for success in the global economy. More information at aasb.org.
The Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. And by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com.
The House Finance Committee today opened hearings on a bill that could lead to the abandonment of the AGEA natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to North American markets. TransCanada Pipeline was awarded the state license to put the project together. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
From the viewpoint of many legislators, problems with the AGEA pipeline arose in the absence of any public disclosure of the results of last year's first marketing offer, called an open season. And the bill on the table now sets a deadline for the administration to determine whether the project is still economically viable. Licensee TransCanada anticipated having some results in December, but there was no legal requirement for that time frame. The measure's sponsor is House Speaker Mike Chenault. He says the public anticipated knowing those open season results before the session began back in January.
The global economic framework AGEA was built on may no longer exist, and that may make AGEA an uneconomic project. And if it is, Mr. Chairman, Alaska needs to know.
Chenault told the Finance Committee that if there is a problem with the AGEA-enabled gas line, the legislature needs to begin looking at its options as quickly as possible. But AGEA supporters say the bill is premature legislation. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra says TransCanada has done nothing wrong under the terms of either the AGEA statute or the license issued by the state.
The worst thing we can do is breach a contract on the biggest project in the state's future. I think we do it this time, we'll never have a gas line in the state. And walking away from a contract where one party has met all its obligations, I think, is going to do nothing but give us a black eye.
And Representative Garrett, through the chair, this does not breach the contract in our opinion. What it does is it makes the administration come back to the legislature and tell us that this is an economical project.
Kara argues there are two ways of looking at the bill. Either it's a breach of contract that adds new material to the project, or it does nothing and does not need to be passed. TransCanada, however, sees the bill as an affront. Tony Palmer, the company's vice president, who's been managing the Alaska operation since the first talk of AGEA appeared, says the bill violates his company's licensing agreement. If it passes, it would change the rules.
It raises uncertainty of the state's support for AGEA at a critical time. We are in negotiations with potential customers. We are continuing those negotiations. And it undercuts the efforts to achieve alignment of all parties necessary for a successful project.
Palmer warned also that the bill, again, if it passes, has the effect of adding definitions and timelines that are not in the original gas line law, and that would serve as a warning for future companies that might consider working with Alaska. He describes a lack of certainty.
The real politic of Alaska, and for any party proposing a project in Alaska, for any party looking for certainty on a contract between yourselves and a third party, will look at this piece of legislation as potentially affecting their future.
The bill's future is uncertain at this point. It was only referred to the Finance Committee, and if it is heard anywhere else, it will be on the floor of the House. The Senate has shown no interest in the measure. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A controversy over constraints on the participants of the Cook Inlet Beluga Recovery Team has letters flying back and forth between state and federal officials and other team members. The issue first arose in January when recovery team leader Tamara McGuire wrote to James Balsiger, the head of NOAA Fisheries for the Alaska region. McGuire's letter said science panel members were unhappy that Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell made clear that state scientists on the recovery team could not speak freely about the plight of the beluga. Other team members worried this would inject politics into the work of developing a recovery plan. The state is suing the federal government over the listing of Cook Inlet beluga as endangered under the Endangered Species Act.
I've worked with the state of Alaska for the last 35 years on various projects or for them, and I've never seen anything quite like this.
Craig Matkin is a biologist with the nonprofit North Coast Oceanic Society and one of the biologists on the panel. He says he has great respect for both Robert Small and Mark Ouellette, the two state scientists who were selected to represent the state on the science panel. But he says it's important that they be allowed to work independently of state policy. And he says that policy has taken a troubling turn in recent years.
I think they've taken some stances that are far more political and hard than I've ever seen before. And without mentioning names, other state scientists that worked for the state for many years have agreed. They've never seen anything quite like this come down from the state. So I'm concerned about it. That's what it is, and I'm concerned about how it could pull us up in the long run. We're already getting balled up in this, and it could just get worse.
NOAA Alaska Region head James Balsiger says he thinks having state biologists on the team is valuable, but given the state's stance on the whales, it will be important to track whether state biologists are talking policy or science.
And I suppose in a perfect world where you didn't need other expertise, if we knew everything, we wouldn't have to have the state biologists on, and we wouldn't have to be careful about whether they're expounding on policy issues, state procedure issues, or biology. But I think when we know this, it's not that difficult to utilize your experience where we need it, utilize the special knowledge that they have. Those biologists have spent more time on Cook Inlet probably than many of our own people that are on this team. So it's kind of a balancing act.
Balsiger says the state has been upfront about their position, and Campbell's letter clarifies that. He says he is confident the state is not trying to undermine the process. But he says other scientists on the team have raised the issue with D.C.-level offices in NOAA, and that could impact how the panel proceeds. Balsiger says because the state is suing NOAA over the endangered listing, they wouldn't want their biologists to say something that might compromise their position in court.
They wouldn't want their biologists to come in and say, boy, the state was sure mixed up when they sued you for that. It's obviously they're really in terrible shape and should be listed. So that they want to make certain that there isn't a state employee that puts that kind of a statement on record.
Fish and Game Endangered Species Coordinator Doug Vincent Lang says the state's position is that the ESA listing is premature, that the beluga population is stabilized and has begun a slow increase. He says the policy laid out in the letter predates Cora Campbell and has been in place for 3 or 4 years. He says there's a lot of disagreement within the department on various elements of what's happening with the Cook Inlet beluga, but those perspectives will be brought forward by the two state scientists, and they must follow department mandates.
Our scientists are not going to be independent scientists participating in this science panel, but more as representatives of the department in the collective view and collective representation, that science perspective on issues affecting beluga whale recovery.
There are two panels involved in planning for the Cook Inlet beluga's recovery. One is a stakeholder panel that has state, oil, and gas industry and NGOs represented on it. Campbell's letter also raised concerns that the science panel meetings were closed to the stakeholders. She wrote that action unnecessarily increases suspicions. She urged the science panel to open its meetings to the stakeholder group. One of the stakeholder panel members, John Shane, worked for Fish and Game for 20 years. He now works for the Audubon Society. He says the stakeholder group is working together well and that is the proper place for the state's views to be heard. But he says autonomous science is vital to the beluga recovery effort. In the 1980s, the Cook Inlet beluga population was around 1,300. Currently, the number is around 300. Shane says few scientists would argue that the whales are in a precarious position and could easily be driven into extinction.
But the state of Alaska's position is against that. It puts the scientists from the state, who, again, I respect, very much respect their integrity and their expertise, it puts them in a very awkward position. It almost makes the science panel dysfunctional.
At this point, it's not clear how the issue will be resolved. A meeting of the science panel is scheduled for April 12th. The Marine Mammal Commission and Cook Inlet Keeper also sent letters expressing strong reservations about the state's position. The letters are at our website, aprn.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, lawmakers question the Goose Creek prison funding as it's nearing completion in the Mat-Su Valley.
I'm not interested in further appropriations into that facility until we figure out what's going on, I'll tell you that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The Mat-Su Valley's new 70-acre prison complex is nearly complete. The Goose Creek Correctional Center will be able to hold 1,500 prisoners. The Department of Corrections had hoped it would open next year, but the legislature voted to withhold the prison's first-year operating budget on Friday. Lawmakers are concerned because Goose Creek would cost the state a projected $70 million per year to run. Some lawmakers think that cost is too high and are considering leaving the prison empty permanently. APRN's Joshua Tucker visited the remote prison and has this story.
At the sprawling prison site, a 30-minute drive from downtown Wasilla, row after row of gray box buildings are in the final stages of construction.
The right-hand side they just did, so if it's not locked, I'll let you at least take a look. So this would be a clinic.
Lee Sherman is with the Department of Corrections. He has been supervising the development of Goose Creek since before construction began 4 years ago. He says the new prison will keep prisoners close to their families in Alaska. The Department of Corrections also hopes they'll do a better job of rehabilitating prisoners while they're at Goose Creek. Currently, 66% of Alaskans who go to prison are sent back at some point. Aspects of the prison were designed to reduce the recidivism rate. The prison's deputy superintendent, Corey Pianco.
You keep them busy with programming and education and viable job experience that they can utilize on the outside. It gives them a lot less time to think about how to become a better criminal while they're in prison.
The cells are the size of an office cubicle. Men are two to a cell, stacked in bunks. But the classroom wing feels different. The floors are carpeted and the walls are painted cheerful colors. Lee Sherman says it's designed to be a learning environment.
There's a library in here, there's a music room in here, there's a GED and testing room in here, and it even has a small chapel. There's substance abuse, there's anger management. I mean, there are a long list of different types of classes.
The Mat-Su Borough built and paid for the prison, but it's the state's job to pay the operating costs each year. And some lawmakers are saying it's too expensive. Alaska currently pays Colorado $20 million per year to incarcerate inmates. It would cost the state $70 million a year to operate Goose Creek. State Senator Bert Stedman co-chairs the Senate Finance Committee, which will have to sign off on the funds.
I can tell you one thing. I'm not interested in spending, if it costs us $20 million a year to house these prisoners, to have that go to $70 million a year just so they can be in Alaska. That doesn't sound like good business to me.
It's up to the legislature to allow the prison to open. Stedman and others are blocking funding until they can get answers on how much the prison will cost to run. He's demanding an audit be completed by next year when the legislature will take up the issue again.
I'm not interested in further appropriations into that facility until we figure out what's going on, I'll tell you that. That's why I want the audit done by January, so we can, you know, get this resolve next session and move on.
Looking at the possibility of an audit, the Mat-Su Borough's project manager for Goose Creek, Russ Kraft, remains confident.
The state legislature has talked about doing an audit. We have our books available. We operate on an open book policy. The auditors come in. We'd be happy to show them more than anything that they want to see.
Until Stedman and other legislators get answers about the prison's operating costs, they are willing to let Goose Creek sit empty. For APRN, this is Joshua Tucker.
Now that the Senate has denied initial operating funds for the prison, the fate of the $240 million facility is questionable. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the Senate Finance Committee is betting that the budget slash will spotlight concerns about the prison's operating costs, but the panel hasn't laid all its cards on the table just yet.
A Senate Finance Committee recommendation not to go ahead with $3.6 million in operating funds for the prison for the next fiscal year has been approved. That's the money State Corrections needs to begin phasing in prison operations when it opens its doors next year. Senator Johnny Ellis says the Senate's move is aimed at prompting an audit of the prison's operating costs.
I have achieved my goal of having greater attention on the whole issue and getting an audit going. I think most members of the public would think, yeah, we need to know how the public has been served or not served by this project.
Ellis admits he and others now concerned about the prison voted in favor of SB 65, the 2004 bill sponsored by then-Senator Lyda Green, which authorized the facility. But after years of planning and many months of public hearings on the prison site, state legislators are questioning the amount of money that it will cost annually to operate the facility, about $71 million.
We knew it would cost something more because of the higher costs in Alaska of doing business, but I think that the final figure was shocking to Senator Stedman in particular. You know, I don't think the executive branch did the best job over the last 7 years of keeping us informed. There are a number of us who think that the Mat-Su Borough, you know, I felt taken advantage of on the utility costs.
Under the agreement with the borough, which paid construction costs, the state will lease the facility for 25 years and pay operating costs. But the eventual prison site complicated the deal.
The boosters of the projects portrayed to us that Mat-Su had open arms. They wanted the prison. Now, the location seemed to become a sticky issue further down the road during the public hearing process. But when it was a bill before the legislature, Mat-Su, you know, pounded the drum and said, we want the prison.
Last year, it was revealed that constructing sewer and water lines to the rural prison would up maintenance costs.
We paid to have the electricity extended from its last point out to the site. We paid for a corridor for NSTAR natural gas line to be extended. And then with the sewer and water, that's where matters became much more complicated.
That's Leslie Houston, director of Department of Corrections Administrative Services. Corrections officials say they have kept lawmakers abreast of prison costs and operating fees.
One of the requirements of Senate Bill 60, the Department of Corrections will pay an annual lease to the borough to offset their debt service. And the cost of that annual lease is $17.8 million. We started in, I believe, February or March of 2009. We have made two payments to the borough of $17.8 million for the lease purchase of the facility.
Houston says prison costs per bed are within the provisions of SB 65, which allowed for inflation. She says that even with inflation, costs per bed come in under the allowable cap. Ellis snorts that legal advice given under a past state administration is now under scrutiny.
They are barely under, based on their calculation that was the most favorable interpretation by the executive branch or the Attorney General's office for the Department of Corrections. So it's a close call for sure.
He says additionally, lawmakers are concerned that the prison program in general did not include strengthening corrections capabilities in rural communities, specifically Bethel. Despite the Senate's high-profile prison budget slash, the House version of the budget retains the $3.6 million for prison operations. Ellis says the next step is negotiation between the Senate and the House on the final version of the state budget.
And I believe that there will be adequate funds to open Goose Creek on time.
He says the public deserves a closer look into the prison costs, and an audit will help do that. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
Tomorrow, in the state's only spring municipal election, Anchorage voters will decide the balance of power in the city's assembly and the fate of 11 ballot propositions. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Currently, the progressives can rally a 6-5 majority in the assembly. Often that edge has been sufficient to pass legislation but not override a mayoral veto. In return, Conservative Mayor Dan Sullivan has found some of his favored legislation fall to the slim majority. During this spring campaign, the mayor and Conservative candidates have blamed the progressives for much of the city's budget shortfalls, primarily through backing union contracts the Conservatives say have excessive salaries and benefits. Conservative candidates say the city's unions exert too much influence over the majority. Meanwhile, the progressives charge the administration and conservatives have failed to use available revenue possibilities and unnecessarily cut city services. The election's outcome will also impact a major issue certain to come soon before the assembly. That's Title 21, a new building and land use code, and the conservative challengers are receiving support from several developers and realtors who do not like the proposed changes. The ballot propositions in tomorrow's Anchorage municipal election include 3 school district and 5 municipal bond packages. The school district bonds total nearly $71 million and the city's propositions $36.5 million. The remaining ballot propositions involve a property tax exemption for widows and widowers of disabled veterans who are under 65. A second would change the municipal charter as to who can issue parking tickets in downtown Anchorage. And finally, there's an advisory asking if anyone buying alcohol in Anchorage package stores should be required to show a photo ID. So far, the assembly has debated but not decided that issue. In Anchorage, I'm Len Anderson.
Former State Senator Dick Eliason has died. The Sitka Republican served 22 years in both chambers of the state legislature, including 2 years as president of the Senate. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
By all accounts, Dick Eliason was not the kind of guy who would get puffed up about titles or power, despite having plenty of both. At Chamber of Commerce luncheons in Sitka, he would introduce himself as Pat's husband. He was like that during his time in the Capitol, too. Mary McDowell was a legislative staffer to Eliason during his entire 12 years in the Senate.
I remember one time being outside of a room where he was meeting with a bunch of students from the district, and one of the students asked him how many staffers were working for him. And he said, well, there are 4 in the office, but they don't really work for me. They work with me.
Eliason's legislative career began when he was elected to the State House in 1969. He served there until 1980, minus one term in the early 70s. When it came to bipartisanship, Dick Eliason walked the walk. The Senate Working Group in the current Alaska State Legislature is a direct descendant of Dick Eliason's bipartisan coalition. Jim Duncan is now the business manager of the Alaska State Employee Association and the former Commissioner of Administration under Governor Tony Knowles. Duncan, a Democrat, served in both the House and the Senate representing Juneau and could not have been further away from Eliason on the political spectrum. Nevertheless, he says it was not difficult to lend Eliason support.
The bottom line was he was doing what he thought was in the best interest of the state of Alaska, and I would agree with him.
Duncan recalls a prank he and fellow Senator Fred Zaroff played on the Senate president. The pair, dressed as Jake and Elwood Blues, accosted Eliason in the hallway of the Capitol and kissed him on the cheeks. A newspaper photographer captured the image and circulated it widely. Duncan says Eliason could roll with any punch.
He, I think, enjoyed that very much and was one who could take a joke. It was meant to be a joke with him, and he took it, and he was just that kind of guy.
Eliason's biggest political mark might have come in 1989 when he sponsored a bill that prohibits fish farms in Alaska. Dale Kelly is executive director of the Alaska Trollers Association.
Alaskans, led by people like Dick, have worked their entire, some of them their entire lives, protecting that habitat.
Kelly's organization represents salmon trollers across the state. In 2006, she nominated Eliason to the Wild Salmon Hall of Fame, but she also says his legacy went beyond fisheries to rural development issues, coastal issues, and most importantly, she says, to his family.
His family that he's raised and who chose to stay at home in Alaska. I think that's a big statement for any human being. To raise a family that loves you and wants to be near you.
Yeah, everything I've learned from my dad.
George Eliason is Dick Eliason's eldest son. He used to go fishing with his dad and is still a commercial fisherman today.
I remember I fell overboard one time and he pulled me out of the water and just said, well, what in the heck were you doing swimming out here, you know? Yeah, we had a good time on the ocean.
Eliason's family life was not contained to his own household. When his good friend Stanley died, he checked in with his widow and her children often to make sure they were all right. One of those children is Cheryl Westover, now the mayor of Sitka.
They lived right up Baranoff, right up Bjorka Street, actually, about a block and a half, and we'd get together and play. You know, I don't remember what the adults did together, but all the kids... The Eliason kids, the Westover kids, the Barden.
Westover's not the only one to consider Eliason a second father. So does McDowell, his former legislative aide.
He wielded a lot of power. He achieved powerful positions and so on, but always kept really good perspective as an Alaskan, and I felt he just really was a statesman.
Former Senator Dick Eliason was 85 years old. With reporting help from Robert Woolsey in Sitka and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, this is Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Josh Tucker reported from the Mat-Su Valley and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.